warning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, May 29th, 2019. We begin with the news section. Just trust us. Raleigh police don't want civilian oversight. The city manager refused to let council members hear otherwise. In December, Raleigh's Human Relations Commission unanimously recommended that the city council create a civilian police review board that has both investigative and subpoena powers. But last Tuesday, when the council heard a long-awaited presentation from the city staff on what Raleigh's oversight board could look like, the HRC's recommendation was conspicuously absent. As it turns out, the city manager's office decided that the council and the public didn't need to hear what the HRC had to say. Instead, Human Relations Director Andrea Caesar told council members that civilian oversight boards are ineffective and recommended a hybrid model that would combine city staffers with civilians. Other possible alternatives included improving the internal affairs process and better community engagement. Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown opposed the independent board, too, telling council members it could hinder police operations and wouldn't offer a be-all, end-all guarantee of accountability. At what point does performance become so restricted that officers cannot do their job? Deck Brown asked. They are the ones running toward danger at the risk of their own lives. Police are already held accountable through the department's accreditation process, Deck Brown said. And in 2018, police used force in only 379 out of 375,900 encounters. The oversight board, she suggested, would be a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. Perhaps that's true, but as reform advocates point out, you'll have to take Deck Brown's word for it. In Raleigh, as elsewhere in North Carolina, the police disciplinary process is incredibly opaque. Under state law, the public can't access officers' personnel files to see what misconduct they've been accused of or disciplined for. If an internal affairs complaint is sustained, residents aren't told how an officer was punished. If the complaint is rejected, there's no recourse and no way to access records, short of a lawsuit. In 2018, the Raleigh Police Department conducted 49 internal affairs investigations. 29 were sustained, resulting in discipline. In the last 6 weeks, Raleigh officers have shot 2 men, 1 fatally. Both appear to have histories of mental illness. On May 19th, Michael Anthony Hendricks Jr., who was holding an airsoft gun, was shot in the abdomen. He survived. On April 22nd, an officer shot and killed Soheil Mazerad, who the police say was brandishing a knife because the officer did not turn on his body camera. There's no footage of that encounter. Calls for an oversight board have grown since Mazerad's death. 3 weeks ago, protesters with the Police Accountability Community Task Force took over a city council meeting to demand action. The options the city staff presented to the council last week fall well short of what the protesters and other advocates said is needed, an autonomous board with teeth. If they implement any of these plans, it will be a slap in the face to the activists who have been trying to create a board with real accountability, says Dawn Blagrove, director of the Carolina Justice Policy Center. The HRC voted for a civilian board that would have access to personnel records, could investigate citizen complaints, and could influence discipline. I think we need one, says HRC member Keith Carlson. There's too many instances of police shootings and other problems in the city without accountability to the citizens. After its vote in December, the HRC asked to present its recommendations to the city council. But the city manager's office refused, according to the HRC's meetings records from February 14th. HRC Chairman Chris Montos said, "There has never been a time when HRC was denied access to the city council," according to the minutes, and asked council member David Cox for help. Cox did not respond to a request for comment. City manager Ruffin Hall could not be reached Tuesday. Montos says he emailed the report to the entire council in February. However, council members Nicole Stewart and Corey Branch said they didn't see it until last week, 3 days after the staff's presentation. That presentation made no mention of the HRC's recommendation, and neither did the HRC's minutes referencing are available on the city's website. The city's position is that a civilian board is impractical because it would require the General Assembly to change the law, which is why nothing like it exists in North Carolina. If state law didn't change, Nick Brown told the council, the board wouldn't have access to personnel files. Without those files, it couldn't take into account an employee's history when making disciplinary decisions. The hybrid model, Caesar said, would have limited access to restricted information. On the downside, internal processes tend to lack the transparency that the community desires. But without transparency, Malta said, you're left trusting the city staff to be neutral. That renders the model ineffective. Bregros says the city should be willing to challenge the legislative. Because it hasn't been done is not an excuse not to do it. We should be leaders in the state on forward-facing policies, especially as it relates to police accountability. The fact that it hasn't been done before, if anything, should incentivize our leaders to get this done. After the presentation, the council voted to have its staff look into improving community engagement. The next news article, the council of no. Here's the problem with Raleigh City Council's draconian Airbnb rules. Closing the book, for now, on what has been often seemed like an interminable 5-year debate, the Raleigh City Council passed strict regulations on short-term rentals like Airbnb last Tuesday. Starting January 1st, whole house rentals will be illegal throughout most of the city, and residents will only be permitted to rent a maximum of 2 rooms in their home to a maximum of 2 adults at a time. Moreover, these rooms cannot have a separate kitchen or privacy from the main dwelling, and homeowners must be living on site. Those violating the new rules will accrue fines of $500 a day, except from the whole house ban are 5 mixed-use districts, mostly downtown, where hotels are already allowed. Rental owners will be required to obtain a $176 permit that must be renewed every year for $86. It's hard to describe how foolish this is. As Airbnb noted in a press release before the vote, it has been 60% year-over-year growth in North Carolina, and taxes on rentals pumped $24 million into state and local coffers last year. But Raleigh's rules crack down on the very things that make the service popular. Short-term rentals offer privacy and space, and whole house rentals can accommodate more people than fit into hotel rooms. Want to bring in the whole family for graduation? Right now, you can rent a North Raleigh townhouse that sleeps 6 for $169 a night. Come January, this will be illegal. The bigger problem. This is that it simply, the council refuses to listen. It has been more than 1,600 days since the city cited Greg Stebbin for renting out his house on Airbnb, then decided to stop enforcing his Airbnb ban while it crafted regulations. There have been countless meetings and public hearings since. Each time, a vast majority of residents urge the city to adopt rules that, while reining in abuses, would allow them to rent their homes to generate extra income or give their families an affordable place to stay when they visit. The council didn't care. What council members cared about were the horror stories they heard from a handful of residents who said their neighborhoods were being ruined by renters taking up street parking or throwing loud parties. Never mind that, since 2014, the city has received only 37 complaints about Airbnbs, of which just 23 were deemed valid, about 4 a year. To be sure, Airbnb has been a mixed bag in some cities. In cities with tight housing markets and large tourism economies, short-term rentals have driven up housing prices. In response, several cities are tightening their rules. But while that's a convenient excuse for the Airbnb-phobic city council, that's not the problem in Raleigh. The city isn't a tourist destination. Airbnb's biggest surge is graduation weekend, and Raleigh's housing prices are skyrocketing because of the predominance of single-family zoning and the city's reluctance to increase the housing stock by adding density. Rather, Airbnb disrupts the status quo. Unlike other disruptions to the status quo, electric scooters, accessory dwelling units, mobile retail, the council's instinct is the same. No. In this case, council members Dickie Thompson and Steph Mendel have argued that neighborhood opposition has led to the city's crackdown. But that opposition has been almost invisible throughout the debate. If there are that many people in Steph Mendel's district and that many people in Dickie Thompson's district that have proposed this, where are they? Stebbin asked. We've never seen them. At a public hearing on May 7th, for example, 12 people addressed the council on short-term rentals. 11 spoke against the city's proposed rules. The council delayed its vote on regulation for at least 2 weeks because Thompson wasn't there, and the pro-regulation camp needed his vote. As it turned out, Thompson had ideas to add. Allowing 4 adults to stay in a house, as was originally proposed, was too much, he argued. He suggested 2. On a 5-2 vote, the council agreed. Nicole Stewart and Corey Branch, not coincidentally, the only council members under the age of 50, dissented. The public never got a chance to weigh in. Not that it would have mattered. Those regulations didn't cover whole house rentals. They were still illegal in most of the city, but there weren't plans to enforce the ban, as council members were still working on those rules. But immediately after the vote, Mendel moved to begin enforcing the whole house ban along with the other rules on January 1st. And while violators were initially going to be fined $100 a day, Councilmember Gay Crowder thought that wasn't enough. She asked for $500. Again, the council agreed, with only Stewart voting no. Again, there was no public input. Our next news article, How the Left Lost the Internet. Using North Carolina as a case study, Duke alumna Jen Schrady's new book argues that conservatives have an inherent digital advantage. Barack Obama made it look easy. His 2008 campaign employed sophisticated digital tools and targeted mobilization strategies the political world didn't fully understand, and his adversaries seemed too stodgy to handle. The years that followed saw the Arab Spring and European anti-austerity protests and Occupy Wall Street, all branches of leftist or liberal activism, with roots online and in social media. For a fleeting minute, this looked like the future. Young, engaged, and egalitarian. The internet was going to be a great equalizer, leveling the playing field between moneyed elites and the rising masses. More than that, progressives assumed, it favored those most adept in utilizing and shaping technology, the young and the educated. In other words, themselves. In 2016, though, this utopian fantasy has been laid bare. Donald Trump, Brexit, far-right populist, nationalist, and illiberal movements in Europe and beyond, all of which also germinated online. Progressive blamed Russian interference and the proliferation of fake news. But a sociologist, Shren Shrady, argues in her new book, The Revolution That Wasn't, how digital activism favors conservatives. That's not the real story. The real story, she writes, is that the dynamics of digital activism aren't all that different from those of traditional activism, and conservatives have the same advantages online that they did before the internet, time and money. If anything, she writes, the web has tilted this balance further in their direction. Shrady, who graduated from Duke in 1989 and spent more than a decade as a documentary filmmaker before going to grad school, reached this conclusion after spending several years on the ground in North Carolina in the early part of this decade, just as a state that appeared to be going blue took a hard right turn. And they are encamping with groups on the left and right as they campaign for and against proposals to allow state employees to collectively bargain. Ultimately, she found an uneven digital terrain that largely abandoned left working class groups while placing right-wing reformist groups at the forefront of digital activism. Shrady, who will be at Quail Ridge Books Friday evening, spoke to the Indy from France, where she's an assistant professor at the Paris Institute of Political Studies, or Sciences Po. This conversation has been condensed and edited for print. The Indy asks, why did you choose North Carolina for your case study? Shrady answered, I was in North California, UC Berkeley, and because I wanted to choose a political issue that attracted both the left and the right, as well as groups from different social classes and different kinds of organizational structures. Because I was in North California, it's really hard to find an issue that attracted the far right there, just around the San Francisco Bay Area. That just weren't a lot of conservative groups. I went to Duke. I stayed in North Carolina and was a documentary filmmaker and also became involved with a lot of the political issues that were happening at that point. I already knew about the collective bargaining issue at North Carolina. Just a few years earlier, before I started the research in 2011, the state had just barely tipped over to Obama. And so it was this purple state. And as I was doing my research in 2012, Obama lost it by a hair. So it really was the perfect mix of having both the left and the right very active in the state. Then he said, your book presents a counter-narrative to the idea that the internet is a naturally progressive medium. I'm wondering what your preconceptions were going in. She said, in 2011, Time magazine had The Protester as the person of the year. And the description was really about what a lot of the media were calling Twitter and Facebook revolutions. And these included not only the well-known Occupy Wall Street, but also what was happening in Wisconsin with the takeover of the State House. And this was on the heels of the Arab Spring and the anti-austerity Indignados movement in Spain. So you have this image of digital activism as being the tool for radical left activists. What I really wanted to do was to delve into what a wider spectrum of groups was actually doing. I expected some social class differences, but even I was surprised at the extent of the digital inequality. But what I did definitely learn as I went along is what, at the time, people were slowly starting to talk about. This idea of filter bubbles. The hyper-focus among journalists and academics was on the left-wing relativist movements, these very digitally visible movements. But meanwhile, underneath the radar, was a highly sophisticated group of conservative activists, some with a lot of resources and more elite, but some very grassroots and organic. They were engaging online. So, with the filter bubble, it wasn't just that we were making claims about digital activism and being that egalitarian tool. We were also not really paying attention to what was happening with groups that were focusing on very, very different issues. And what I found in the process is not only that conservative groups with more resources and more vertical structures were using the internet more, but that they used it also in a very different way. Dandy then said, "You write about labor groups in eastern North Carolina that had no web presence at all. We tend to think of liberal groups as having sophisticated and internet machines." She answered, "It's fascinating, even talking to some conservative activists who themselves were really engaged online and were very sophisticated and still didn't even recognize their own digital power. In many ways, that surprised people with Donald Trump's election or even the 2014 election in North Carolina. I think people were really surprised at this infrastructure that had been brewing for a long time. I think North Carolina is a really good example of what was happening nationally. You had that very strong ecosystem of grassroots conservative organizations working in sync with conservative media. And it's not just Fox News or even Breitbart, but a much broader spectrum and locally." Then he went on, "What did conservatives get about the internet that progressives didn't?" She said, "There are a couple of areas where conservatives really have got the advantage. One is that they have this ecosystem of information that they were able to share, reshare, etc. So you have resources here. And it's not just funding. It was also time. Tea Party activists in particular tend to be older or retired, so they really had time to dedicate to the work of digital activism. It takes a lot of effort." But there's also the piece of pure political ideology that works to the advantage of conservatives. In very simplistic terms, conservatives tend to focus on freedom. Progressives tend to focus on fairness. There was another difference related to this ideology. When I talked to activists on the left, they were very concerned with getting as many people to participate in this very egalitarian way. The internet was just one tool to enable that to happen. But when I talked to conservative activists, their eyes would light up. They were so much more excited about how the internet could counter what they viewed as the disinformation of the mainstream media. They felt really alienated, and they really felt like it was their way to be allowed to deliver the truth. Then he then went on, You referenced the late economist Mancur Olson's theory about collective action, that it's irrational to participate, so those with a certain level of comfort are more likely to commit time and resources to do so, And the notion that this idea applies to something as basic as posting articles online. That's an interesting way of looking at Olson's research 50 years after he did it. She responded, "While the cost of participation is so much lower with the internet, the problem is that not everyone has those same disposable totals of time to come to the table. Certainly over time, more and more people adopt. But the problem is that if you don't have those resources, it's a constant struggle. And it's not just the tools. It's new platforms that are being introduced. It's a moving target." The Indy asked, "You wrote that while a lot of people were shocked when Trump won the elections. You weren't. Why?" She answered, "When I first started to present my preliminary results around 2014, I would talk about the general findings that you and I have been discussing, and especially among more leftist scholars and activists, that they were wary. They were like, 'What are you talking about?' They didn't disbelieve my data, but I think they just couldn't come to terms with the fact that conservatives were more active online. And for me, it wasn't just this idea now that's being promoted. It wasn't just fake news or people being duped by Trump, or what I think is kind of the narrative now. There was this groundswell of support that really has been growing for a long time, even before 2009, but really with the birth of the Tea Party movement. People on the ground were organizing extensively. I could see that they had a much better digital footprint that wasn't separate from what was going on, but really reflected the political organizing that was going on." Dandy then asked, "Is there something in the message that the left should be taking from these conservative groups which were so focused on Obama and national issues like the Affordable Care Act that are now focused on a large degree on supporting Trump?" She answered, "Being as catchy as possible without diluting your message is essential with social media. And it's not just the words. The images are huge. They're so important, and especially if we think about the movement toward Instagram in particular and other more visual mediums, images, memes, GIFs. That's what people are sharing. That's what people are laughing about. That's what people do get angry about. It's a powerful way to convey your message." And then the last question. "You did a lot of this research several years ago. The internet changes very fast. Platforms change. Algorithms change. The book's coming out now. Do you think the fundamental premise of the book has been affected by the changes in how the internet works today versus 8 years ago?" And she answered, "I think it's even more dramatic and apparent now than it was before. I don't think the digital activism gap has gone away." Our next news article, A Proud Legacy. On the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, Raleigh gets its first Pride Month. Early on June 28, 1969, New York City cops raided the Stonewall Inn, a club in Greenwich Village that was owned by the mob and offered refuge to the LGBT community and sold liquor without a license. Raids weren't uncommon, but usually bent cops tip off the bar first. Not this time. The police arrested 13 people, staff, for selling bootleg booze, customers for violating laws on gender-appropriate clothing. But patrons and neighbors didn't disperse. Instead, they gathered outside and watched a cop club a woman over the head as he forced her into a paddy wagon. She cried out. They responded, launching bottles and stones at the police. When the cops holed up inside the stone wall, the crowd set it on fire. Firefighters put it out. A riot ensued, and the uprising became a catalyst for the gay rights movement in the United States. The first large-scale Pride Parade took place 1 year later. ever since June has been Pride Month in most of the U.S., but not in Raleigh. Durham and Raleigh both host Pride parades in September, and for nearly a decade, Out Raleigh has drawn thousands downtown in May. But there's never been a month-long Pride observation in the city of Oaks. On that 50th anniversary of Stonewall, that's changing. I think that this is something Raleigh needs, says Vendere Chocolate Factory General Manager Roxanne Lundy, the brains behind Raleigh Pride. Along with Trey Roberts of Wake Up, Wake County, and Josh Lum of Raleigh Provisions, Lundy has spent the last several months organizing the month-long celebration, Raleigh Pride, which kicks off June 1st and will benefit the LGBT Center of Raleigh, aims to create a sense of awareness and inclusivity through family-related events, concerts and parties, and visible support from local businesses. The organizers say they don't want to supplant Out Raleigh or the parade in September. Instead, they want to create something that coexists with these other events. Lundy got the idea from a visit to New York City during Pride Month. Everything was decked out for Pride, she said. I couldn't believe that Raleigh didn't have that. She first reached out to the center to create a Pride-themed chocolate bar. Then, with Lamb and Roberts, began contacting downtown businesses to encourage them to put on their own Pride-themed events and help raise money for the center. The idea quickly gained traction. Mayor Nancy McFarland offered her personal support. Tito Vodkas has pledged to match a donation to the city up to $10,000. We have no direct hands in a lot of these events, Lamb said. They really were just super supportive of what we were trying to do. Some examples. Runology will host a Run for Love 5K on June 1st. Alamo Drafthouse has weekly Pride screenings, with a portion of proceeds going to the LGBTQ Center. City Market will feature a Pride-themed night market. Several venues will hold panel discussions about everything from entrepreneurship to sexual health to the hospitality industry. There's a chance to meet Raleigh City Council candidates on June 23rd at the Dairy. Concerts, drag shows, and night parties will all be held around the state. But for all the celebrations, the organizers are careful not to overlook the history. This month's marquee event, the Opulence Ball, June 23rd at VAE Raleigh, will celebrate the Stonewall activists and the late Martha P. Johnson, a transgender woman who was celebrating her 25th birthday the night the riots broke out and helped instigate the resistance to the police that night. She later co-founded Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, which helped young and hopeless trans women of color. None of what's happened is accepted now and should come at the cost of history. None of that should be forgotten just because things are easier for certain individuals at this point. And now this week's feature article, The Past Isn't Even Past. North Carolina's most prestigious universities were built on white supremacy. Its legacy still lingers. In 1836, the estate of Edenton planter John Blount was donated to the two-year-old Wake Forest College with the proceeds designated to support poor and indigent young men destined for the ministry. The bequest included land and, when Blount's widow died in 1859, 14 enslaved people who were auctioned for $10,718, the equivalent of about $330,000 today. For the first 128 years of its existence, this institution, whose endowment was financed in part by black bodies, excluded black students. And when Wake Forest University finally admitted a black student in 1962, he was Ghanaian, not African American. The university's troubled history with race burst into the open in February, the same time Virginia Governor Ralph Northam faced a scandal over appearing in blackface in the 80s, with the revelation that the university's dean of admission and an assistant dean of admissions had posed with the Confederate flag as students in the 1980s. During one of two public apologies, Dean of Admissions Martha Allman said she didn't think that much about what the flag signified in 1982 when she took part in the group photo as the sweetheart of Kappa Alpha Order fraternity. She was engaged to a member. "I was not politically active," Allman told administrators and faculty in April. "I was not engaged in discussions about diversity, nor involved in issues of social justice. In retrospect, I'm ashamed of what lack of awareness, but it's true. I read applications, and I meet new students, and I'm aware that there are a lot of students who become aware of in their youth, and for others, it just takes longer." Many of Wake Forest's black students, who comprise 9.4% of the student body, say there's never a time on campus when they can avoid thinking about race. "It seems like blackness is something that other people need to figure out how to navigate in academic and social meetings," says Kate Pearson, a rising sophomore. "My blackness is something I have to wear on my sleeve, which is exhausting." Wake Forest is part of a troika of elite universities in North Carolina, alongside the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Duke University, that have outsized influence in the state politics, business, and medicine, and law. Their renowned research, institutions that feed hospital systems and influence cultural discourse through highly regarded faculty. And these three have produced U.S. presidents, senators, governors, and judges. Richard Burr and Jesse Helms, Wake Forest. Governor Cooper, former Governor Jim Hunt, U.S. Representative David Price, and Virginia Fox, UNC. Former President Nixon and Trump policy advisor Stephen Miller from Duke, among others. In particular, UNC Chapel Hill, mythologized as a light on the hill, has held a reputation as an engine of progress in North Carolina. As former Governor Terry Sanford's observed in a 1990 interview, most of the state's leaders have come from Chapel Hill, which had the concept of how to make the world better as a function of the university. Compared to the nation's other top-ranked university, these are relatively diverse institutions. Among U.S. News and World Report's top 30 universities in the U.S. in 2017, Duke has the fourth highest percentage of African-American students. Wake Forest has fifth. UNC Chapel Hill has ninth, the highest ranking among public institutions in that elite group. But these are still predominantly white institutions. At each school, as of 2017, black students comprised less than 10% of the student body, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics, though they accounted for more than 21% of the state's population. For many black students, enrolled at these schools offers access to resources they wouldn't have at historically black colleges, but it comes at a steep psychological cost. Growing up in North Carolina, Jerry J. Wilson watched his two eldest sisters attend mostly white schools in the UNC system, only to drop out. Another set of sisters attended the HBCUs and graduated. "But it was my turn. I got a strong nudge from my parents to consider an HBCU," Wilson said. He chose Fayetteville State University, which offered him the best financial aid package. Wilson is now a doctoral student at UNC Chapel Hill School of Education. "When I got here to Carolina, things were very different from Fayetteville State programs, scholarships, study abroad, and faculties," Wilson said. so much, so many more resources that I had access to at Fayetteville Street. I remember being in awe, like, wow. That's why I go back to this notion of democratic equality. What it means for the flagship institutions to have all these resources, yet have this disparity when it comes to enrollment by race, he continues. Because the reality is, it's not just what you know, it's also who you know, and what type of resources you have access to. It is the case that students at other universities may be receiving a wonderful education, but how well they're able to take advantage of their opportunities is outside of their control. In terms of opportunities for research, we have Nobel laureates on the faculty at Chapel Hill. That means something for young people who are applying for other opportunities and are interested in certain topic or need an introduction or a research apprenticeship. Aries Powell attended mostly white K-12 schools in Delaware, but wasn't prepared for the intensity of whiteness in Wake Forest. It's pervasive, in-your-face, violent whiteness, says Powell, who uses gender-neutral pronouns. Wealthy, elite whiteness. I'm solidly middle class. I'd always gone to school with people making similar amounts of money. I had a lab partner, and he was like, I'm going to drop out. I'm like, what? He said, it's no problem. My dad owns a potato chip company. I'll just go to work for him. While Powell describes Wake Forest as an adversarial place, academically and socially, they, too, acknowledge several advantages. They received a full-ride scholarship, ducking $200,000 of debt. The university paid for 2 study abroad experiences in sending Powell to Cuba and Ghana. And undergrads with the requisite GPA or LSAT scores are automatically admitted into Wake Law. While UNC Chapel Hill is a public university and Wake Forest is not, their histories of racetrack are closely tied together. At UNC Chapel Hill, slavery also played a clear role in establishing the university. Enslaved persons literally built the facilities. The first public university in the United States, UNC Chapel Hill, which was chartered in 1789 and opened in 1795, excluded black people for the first 156 years of its existence, and then it integrated only because it had to. In 1951, a federal court ordered the university to admit 5 black graduate students under the separate but equal doctrine because the state didn't adequately fund medical and law programs at black institutions. 4 years later, UNC Chapel Hill admitted 3 black students, all graduates of Durham's Hillside High School, to comply with a Brown v. Board of Education. 5 years later, in 1960, there were still only 4 black freshmen. UNC's website tells a flattering version of what happened next. While there were just 113 black students in 1968 after a major recruitment initiative, 138 professional, 946 undergraduate freshmen were enrolled in 1978. The university has become a national leader in this area. Like other prestigious schools, UNC Chapel Hill has made public commitments to increasing diversity over the years. In 2000, for example, the Minority Affairs Review Committee declared this goal a fundamental prerequisite to both educational excellence and the university's ability to serve all the people of the state. However, black enrollment at UNC Chapel Hill actually plateaued in the late 90s, and then began to drop in 2010, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics. UNC spokeswoman Kate Luck said, changes in federal reporting guidelines account for a 1.5 percentage point decline between 2009 and 10. Even so, the percentage of black students at UNC Chapel Hill fell to 85.5% by 2017. Similarly, NC State, the state's largest public university, with more than 33,000 students, saw black enrollment top out at 10.4% in 2000 and fell to 7.2% by 2017. Duke University, founded in 1838, didn't admit a black graduate student until 1961, and black undergrads until 1963. Black enrollment at Duke increased from 6.5% in 1990 to 10.6% in 2004, fell to 8.3% in 2010, and rebounded to 9.5% in 2017. In the late 70s, as public institutions like UNC Chapel Hill were making strides in increasing black enrollment, Wake Forest found himself under pressure to become more diverse. Herman Uhr, one of the university's first two tenure-track black faculty members, created the Office of Minority Affairs in 1978. Martha Allman was a freshman that year. After graduating in 1982, Allman went to work as an admissions counselor at the alma mater, then became the undergraduate admissions director in 2001. In that role, in 2008, she instituted test optional admissions to reduce barriers for black and brown students, making Wake Forest the first top university to do so. Under her leadership, the share of students of color in Wake's undergraduate program has risen from 14.8% in 2007 to 22.9% in 2017. During her second public apology for posing with a Confederate flag in college, Allman boasted that the Wake Forest non-white population has now grown to over 30%. University spokeswoman Katie Neal says Allman's figure accounts for international students. But the share of black undergrads has barely budged from 6.8% in 1990 to 7.5% in 2017, according to the National Center for Educational Statistics. Higher numbers of students of color in graduate programs push African American representation across all levels up to 9.4%. but still well below African Americans' 35% share of the population in Winston-Salem. Nate French, who heads Wake Forest Magnolia Scholars Program to support first-generation students, says the reason for African Americans' underrepresentation is straightforward. It's a poor K-12 preparation program. We can't recruit students if they're not prepared to come out of high school. I think the report last year in Winston-Salem is that only 27% of African Americans hit third grade proficiency. That number is not going to go up exponentially by the time they get to the 12th grade. Meanwhile, high-achieving students of color, or for that matter, low-income or rural students, are highly sought after by higher-profile recruiters. I think all of the schools, and I've been out on the road recruiting for Wake, you're trying to beat the bushes to find students, French said. But if you find one or two or three, and this is red or yellow or black or white, if you find a kid that can get into Wake, they can get into Carolina. They can get into state. Everybody's going for that student, so there's a lot of competition there. During their first year at Wake Forest, Aries Powell took part in a historic simulation set in Greenwich Village in the 1910s and 20s. The story was about labor, says Powell, but the class's white students shifted the narrative to class, and Powell was the only African-American among them. Powell used the word Negro, wanting to be historically accurate, a decision that quickly registered as their counterparts began to using the word with relish. The white students ran wild with, records Powell, who graduated in May 20th. I said, can we stop? This is a little much. The professor made me plead my case and then put it to a vote. Beyond the everyday racism that Powell experienced, more overt and outrageous examples are legion at Wake Forest. Among those have been the news in the past 5 years. A bucket of urine was placed outside a black Muslim chaplain's office. A white fraternity invited guests to dress like performers in a rap video. The night of Donald Trump's election, white students ran around campus yelling the N-word. A white student called her black advisor the N-word. A student's Instagram post called for a wall separating Wake Forest from the HBCU Winston-Salem State University. Everyone in your classes could be incredibly racist, Powell says. Your roommate could be incredibly racist. The thing that's so absurd is the consistency. Ask what Wake Forest is doing to combat racism on campus. Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion, Jose Villalba, points to a workshop that includes discussions on multicultural competence and microaggressions that all first-year students are required to attend. Like Wake Forest, Duke University has its own episodes of racial tension. Last year, Vice President Larry Mineta made news after his complaints about rap music at an on-campus coffee shop got two baristas fired. Earlier this year, Megan Neely, a graduate director in the university's medical program, stepped down following a backlash that emerged over an email she wrote admonishing Chinese students to speak English 100% of the time. And in 2014, Executive Vice President Tallman Trask III allegedly called a black park attendant a dumb, stupid N-word after striking her with his Porsche, leading to days of student protests in 2016 after a lawsuit brought the incident to light. Gary Bennett, Duke's Vice Provost for Education, told the Indy in a statement that the university is constantly working to cultivate a climate in which free expression is encouraged and one that is characterized by mutual respect, appreciation for difference, and inclusivity. For Jerry J. Wilson, being one of the few black grad students at UNC Chapel Hill, often means feeling that his academic interests are devalued. For us in the School of Education, for me and other students of color, it's trying to find scholarship with which we identify, he said. A lot of us prefer more critical work, work that challenges dominant narratives, work that aims to transform oppressive system. There are few faculty in the School of Education that take that approach. He's not alone. In November, under pressure from students, including Wilson, the university published a 2-year-old survey in which nearly 2/3 of the black or African-American students and staff said they felt isolated in class because of the absence or low representation of people like me. As evidence of UNC Chapel Hill's progress in increasing underrepresented minority enrollment, spokeswoman Kate Luck says that 8.6% of first-year students at UNC Chapel Hill identify as African-American, the highest percentage among U.S. News and Report's top 25 public institutions. But if you include all undergraduate and graduate students, three of those top public universities, the University of Maryland, Rutgers, and the University of Georgia, have a higher representation of black students than UNC Chapel Hill's 8.5%, according to analysis of the National Center for Education. Even Carolina's level of diversity is under assault from those who consider its affirmative action. A group called Students for Fair Admissions sued the university in 2014, claiming that UNC's consideration of race in admissions equates to a penalty imposed upon white and Asian American applicants. The group has filed similar lawsuits against Harvard and the University of Texas at Austin, which are expected to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. In February, members of the Wake Forest Anti-Racism Coalition took over a forum on inclusivity hosted by Villalba. But while they called attention to Almond's picture with the Confederate flag, their concerns and demands went further. They demanded a dedicated space for the Black Students Alliance, a zero-tolerance policy for acts of white supremacy, transparency in the bias-reported process, additional black counselors to support black students, and the removal of monuments and building names that commemorate God Confederates and eugenicists. In addition to Almond's two apologies, the administration responded by designating a lounge at Kitchen Hall for the Black Student Alliance. "We had to literally shut stuff down to get that," Powell said. "We had to make this administration afraid of us. This campus does not cater to or care about black students." The university has also pledged to review its bias reporting system, and President Nathan Hatch announced that a commission on race, equity, and community will convene in September. Black student activists at Wake Forest say that increasing diversity isn't their top priority. There's too much bigotry to ask new students to join them. "The new black enrollment stat is depressing and disgusting, but the fewer students of color, the better as a matter of harm reduction. This campus has the potential to be a great place for black students. We are at the beginning of a long path. We are a long way from black students being safe and okay here. I don't want to tell black students to be here to enlist them in my war. I understood that I was taking on this work when I came here." Meanwhile, at UNC Chapel Hill, which unlike Duke and Wake Forest, often finds itself at the mercy of state politicians, black students and faculty are pushing forward amidst uncertainty over the future of Silent Sam, with the UNC Board of Governors' recent announcement that a decision over the fate of the Confederate monument will be delayed indefinitely. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.